in the Olympics. I know what I'm doing.
Coaches, welcome back to the Talking Split podcast. I am, as always, Rob Coulter, and I am joined today by Nathan Cooper-Brown, Zoe Carr. Welcome to you both.
Thank you for having us.
Good to be back.
Excellent to have you both back in. Obviously, you're going to hear about the topic very soon, but we are talking Olympics coming up. We've got a couple of little housekeeping things to take care of first. If you can follow along on the Talking Split socials via the @TalkingSplit handle on both X and Instagram, that would be fantastic. What is crazy is the amount of people that have emailed me over the last month and a half since we haven't been doing the pod. Oh, I've just found it. How have you only just found it? Every week we tell people, please like, share, subscribe the pod if you could. Leave ratings, leave reviews, all of that sort of stuff. If you can help share the podcast, that would be fantastic because there are obviously tons of coaches out there that are looking for resources, that are looking for additional content that they can potentially use with that space. If you do like what you're hearing, please leave a rating and review. We did have one coach leave a review on the iTunes podcast saying that, hey, we learn a lot about coaching and also barbecue. So,
On the iTunes.
On the iTunes.
Is that the same as the Facebooks?
The Facebooks. It is all known as the social media, and I have disdain for all of them. But that would be a fantastic help to any coaches out there that are able to help share the podcast. We do have a coach shout out. I am working on music for it. Haven't quite got there yet. It's been a busy couple of weeks. This is in the way of a coach shout out to my daughter's coach and assistant coach of the under-12-3 Kilsyth Cobras. They are a father and daughter duo, Dean and Caitlin Groves. Dean's our head coach and Caitlin is their assistant. And together they are a powerhouse. Dean and Caitlin have earned the respect and loyalty of their team, taking the time to get to know each of the players on a personal level. In their own time, they've offered skills coaching, have made the effort to travel to interstate tournaments, and have matched the girls' commitment to excellence. Dean and Caitlin encourage the girls to understand that the job is never truly done, and there is always room to get better. They have brought all of our families together and made a real community for us all. The season has been a true pleasure, win or lose. Our girls love showing up to be coached by them. So, phenomenal shout-out from the coaching perspective. It is fantastic to get a coach shout-out like that. We do appreciate it from that end, and it's great to get some coach recognition for any of the other coaches out there. So, if you do have anyone that you want to shout out in your coaching world, that would be fantastic. Whether you be a parent of a child that's going through, whether you be a coach that has been helped out by another coach somewhere, that would be fantastic to pay it forward and just give a little bit of recognition there where they can. Back in the country, Coops. It's been a while.
Has been.
How is Turkey?
It's not somewhere I'm keen to get back to.
We were the same,
quickly.
Oddly enough. Yeah. We didn't love our time in Turkey. Food poisoning had something to do with that, to be completely fair.
That'll help. Yeah. That's what it was like. It was hard work. It was amazing to be over that side of the world. Obviously, somewhere, you know, to be able to travel on basketball's dime is pretty spectacular. And it had its moments, you know, the Blue Mosque and the Grand Bazaar and seeing that culture and that city was really cool. But, yeah, you know, a lot of charlatans, a lot of things that made it hard work. And we haven't spoken about the basketball yet. So, again, it's not... Not somewhere I'm rushing back to, but very grateful to have experienced it.
Yep, so went through, obviously, as a head coach, first-time head coach. So you've done a number of international tournaments before as an assistant. First time in the head coaching chair. How did you find it?
I head coached in PNG at Oceania.
True, you did too.
I'm going to go out on a limb and say it's a little bit different at a World Cup. I can just feel the social media people going nuts over that controversial statement. So first time World Cup head coach. This event has gone to a new stratosphere. Even speaking to the higher-ups at, you know, BA and some other notable coaches, just talking about, you know, this is probably the best under-17 World Cup they've ever seen. And I couldn't agree more. The effort made by the Turkish Federation for the production value and the gravitas and the seriousness of the tournament was outstanding. Like the Senin Ernem Dome, you know, 16,500 people, you know, stadium. You know, they got the court lit up. There's music. Like, it really felt like a senior event. There's security everywhere. You get a police escort to your bus to venues. Like, it really had this big feel to it, and then the teams and the coaching staffs didn't disappoint. This is their biggest athletes I've seen at that event, the most talented, you know, huge coaching staffs. The German head coach had coached at an Olympics before, you know, they brought him back, you know, to give their team the best chance. Like, this thing was, yeah, has really gone to a new level, and you can see that this is the new floor. You know, the under-19s now, you know, a lot of the top players are already going pro and are deciding that maybe that's not the best event for them. So you can see that other nations are saying, okay, let's go back to the 17s. This thing has real weight now. You know, college coaches, pro scouts, everybody in the room knowing, okay, like the kids that are in this thing are super talented and they're not that far away from, you know, going pro and so on. And, you know, one of the kids, AJ Dimbansa from the United States, is the projected number one pick in a couple of years' time. So, yeah, it was an incredible, incredible experience. And obviously, you know, the result didn't go our way. Topping the pool was outstanding, beating Canada. I don't think a Crocs team had beaten Canada before. You know, that was pretty cool. And then, yeah, you tournament play is full of bad luck, and we copped that in, you know, getting the second best team in the world on the round of 16 crossover and being up 19 points, you know, in the third quarter and losing in overtime was obviously heartbreaking. But, you know, I get reminded that stoicism was born out of disaster. It was born out of a shipwreck. And, yeah, you know, fate had this in store for us, for me, to have to go there and go through what happened and obviously happened after that loss and where we finished. The sad part is, you know, that I never want collateral for those things, and that's what, you know, the kids at, you know, at their heart were really good kids, you know, and the staff were absolutely amazing, and you know, to see them, you know, not experience the success that I wanted for them was probably the hardest thing, but for me personally, looking at it as the learning experience, as the disaster that hopefully births a better version of myself, is that's the highlight.
Yeah, appreciate you going through that. We obviously watched a lot of the games. We had a vested interest in it. Even like game one against Egypt, like we're sitting there saying, I feel like we're a lot better team than Egypt. Like we should win this game fairly comfortably and just go through that mixer of, okay, different playing style, the game's officiated very differently, what is taken away from you that you would normally get doesn't come quite as easy anymore. Like the whole, it's just such a different game, like, yeah. Which we'll obviously touch on with the Olympics as we move forward. But did you, obviously you were aware of that going into it, but how did you feel in those moments where you kind of have that feeling like, yeah, I feel like we should be ahead here. It's just not going how I want it to go.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like international basketball more than any is a game of runs. And I think we've spoken about that before. And Zoe obviously knows, you know, better than anyone. And it's so hard to convey to the athletes what this thing is like and how it's going to go. And, you know, because we just don't play enough international games. You know, as Zoe's spoken about before, you know, these Spanish team and the French team, like they get together a month in advance and they play 20, you know, 20 international meaningful games and really have a feel for this thing. And our kids get over there and get punched in the mouth and just are looking around like, what is going on? Like, what is this basketball? And so, yeah, so you've just got to keep driving the narrative of, you know, no team quits. Like, even when you're up big, it's still hard. Mm. You know, like it's like no team stops playing. Like they're playing for their country. Like there's a fight in them that pushes them to play their best basketball at every turn. And then it's just whether they have that skill to quite, you know, get over the line. But yeah, like the level of physicality, you know, hard to prepare for. You know, level of skill, you know, hard to prepare for. Like the Egyptian kids were just knockdown shooters, and a credit to them, you know, that they knew, you know, that they had to do that to be competitive. And, you know, they're pick and pop big, making threes and guards shooting behind screens. And you know, you turn around and you're like, guys, this is what we spoke about in the scout. Like, mm-hmm. This is, they don't, you know, teams don't go away. And that's definitely something I would try and do a lot better, you know, if I was lucky to get the job again, is to try and paint a better picture of what it's going to feel like before the kids got on the plane. Like we try to do it, but I think I'd need to try harder.
Yep.
For the next group. Yeah.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. And you know, and until you're there, you don't really know what it's like either. Like you are living the life of a pro athlete and coach in the truest sense of the word. but so have a lot of these other kids. And I think that's kind of taken for granted a lot that, okay, yes, you're at the finals of a World Cup. Like, you're not just at the World Cup where everybody gets to send a team. You're at the finals. Everyone's had to qualify through this regime.
And that's right.
I'm sure everyone sort of looked at it and it's like, oh, we only just got over Egypt. Like, that's unusual. Yeah, okay. Well, Egypt have come over to Africa and they've had to beat some teams to get there. Like, the African continent produces basketball players. Like, it's not a massive shock, I don't think. But it is amazing how quickly people can forget. And I'm sure if you're not sick of going over it in your own head and talking to other people about it, you can't be far away. So I appreciate you going through it with us. But it is one of those areas where it's such a different world. It's such a different level. Like, we can all sit there and, oh, I would have done this. And, you know, I do that all the time, like, especially this last week and a half. It's like, I'm a genius sitting on my couch watching the Olympics. But, you know, in the actual heat of the moment, and, you know, you can't prepare for it. And seeing so many players come from so many different backgrounds to try and formulate into a team is difficult. Like, it's just not that easy to be able to do. Like, is that similar to your experience, Zoe, when you went through Worlds?
Yeah, it's whatever you think the biggest moment for our athletes is here in Australia, like, put it on crack. Like, it is that's what the Worlds is. It is elevated athletes, coaching, strategy, you know, nerves, all those sort of things are 10 times what you would experience here in, say, and I'm not trying to dismiss it, but in, say, like a VC grand final, for example. So it's the management of all of that is really tough. And the management then, you know, if you do cop a loss or something like that, of having to then get back is so much harder because you're
trying
not
to right the ship.
You're not then coming up against, you know, a dud team or something. Again, like you said, you're coming up against a team who's beaten teams in basketballing countries to get here. So there is not a single easy game. And there might be games where you sort of win big, but they're not easy. And it's something I wish more of us could understand. Or at least be considerate of. And I know I rant about this a lot on the pod, but before we set to social media or online.
Oh, a bit of a social media hater. Welcome.
Yeah.
Welcome on board, everyone.
Before you get on the Facebooks or, you know, forums or whatever, I really wish we'd have a bit more of an understanding of what these things are. Nobody goes there to have those things happen. And tournament play, as Coop said, is brutal.
Yeah, like, how's copping Italy in a who then go on to play in the gold medal game?
That is the worst round of 16 crossover I have ever seen. And when I say worst, matchup.
Yeah.
I've never seen that before. So, yeah, it's rough.
Yeah.
But, you know, like you said, it's real easy when you're sitting on your couch, or we're watching a few of your games, Coops, laying in bed because it was like stupid o'clock in the morning. And
not a brilliant time zone.
But yeah, I wish for us to, as a fraternity, to gain more compassion and kindness.
It's funny, especially these last week and a half or so, like, the internet, this is one of the few times I have been on social media over the last couple of weeks, because it has been enjoyable with the Olympics going on, with just the amount of like carnage and the memes and all that sort of stuff that has been going on. But one that really resonated me was the old overweight fat guy sitting on the couch with like chips resting crumbs on the belly, crumbs all over his top, and it's just like, oh, that player sucks. Like, they can't do anything.
He's
like
pathetic.
They're pathetic. It's like, just put it into perspective a little bit here. We are talking about an international event, and, you know, this will transfer straight into the Olympics, which we're about to get into now. You don't get there if you're a bad team.
But also, too, when you're talking about junior worlds, they're still children. They're still kids. This is their step to get to then, say, the Olympics or the Senior World Cup or something like that. So by the time they get there, they've had at least a little bit of experience in that in that field.
These are kids that we hope will be at the Australian Olympics in, what, 2032?
That's right.
Like, that's what this is preparation for.
Again, you think about the perspective, like, we have four kids coming back to, you know, VJBL, Saturday morning school basketball, and whereas the France team's going back to the Paris Academy, and the Spanish team's going back to Barcelona's academy. And you know what I mean? Like, these kids are going back to, like, elite pro club academies where that's the only basketball they do. That's where they lift weights. That's where they have more access to their national team. Kids are coming back to VJBL.
Well, like, when we spoke about it offline, but I'll talk about it here, one of the under-16 athletes, Matty Ryan, that just went away and represented Australia, has like 25 points and a ridiculous stat line, then comes back and plays
as a double bottom
as a double bottom major, then comes back and plays under-16 VC, where there's nothing even remotely close to the same level that what she's just gone and seen. So trying to bridge that gap is going to be complex. And look, there are a number of reasons why it is complex, financial being probably one of them, just simple logistics of Australia. Like, you can jump on a plane for 4 hours and you're still in Australia. You jump on a plane in Europe or America and you get obviously a different type of basketball that we probably don't get enough exposure to be completely fair. So it is one of those things that we do have to manage a little bit more, because we'd be ignorant to not sit there and think, well, okay, Junior Worlds are important for sure, but they're also a preparation tournament for our Senior Worlds.
That's right.
And our Senior Olympics and those sorts of things. Like, that's really the focus, is can we set these players up to have success further on down the road?
I mean, even just, you know, the COE not being able to compete in NBL 1 South is impacting what these guys are able to do internationally. Like, there's so many moving pieces to this, and we need to collaborate more and do what we can to help these kids have more success early on, because we know it's going to translate down the line. And we spoke about that a lot, especially after the Italy loss. We spoke about after the tournament that, you know, I really hoped that, you know, this was going to be a catalyst for them and something they could really draw upon as they strive to wear green and gold again, and that, you know, myself and the staff would support them in that, you know, for the rest of their journey.
Oh, excellent. And, you know, honestly, Coops, congrats. Like, one, it's a hard job to get, and it's an even harder job to go through, like, it's as it turns out. So congrats on getting through everything as well and being in a position where you've come out the other side and still have aspirations to go further with it. It's, you know, it's a big deal, as it turns out.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate that, and really appreciate so much support and kind words of people in our community coming back. Because it was a little bit rough, and to come back and have people like yourselves and a lot of people out there be so supportive was outstanding and really means a lot. So thank you to everybody.
Easy done. So we are recording this on a Tuesday. This will get released on a Friday, so bear in mind that everything we say for the next 40 minutes may very much have changed. We're trying to do a lot of forecasting here because the Boomers play tonight and the Opals play tomorrow night, as we're going to talk about this. So there's a little bit of, hey, you know, maybe forget that last 7 minutes as we go through a few of these things. We have been super lucky with the time zone friendly games for us, and even just being able to turn on the telly and watch in prime time some of the best international teams playing, honestly, this is just my heaven. Like, I love this more than anything else. So we've been very lucky. What seems like an eternity ago, we picked teams for the Olympics though. And there was obviously a lot of talk around, they've selected the wrong teams, they've selected the right team, how could you leave this player out, what is that player doing in, and all that sort of stuff. And full transparency, I've been one of those people that has used the Olympic Games as a bit of an education piece for a lot of coaches that we've had. So we had that accelerated women's coaching program that ran up in Bendigo recently with the under-16 Nationals. And one of the things we spoke about was, okay, pick your Opals. Like, you work out what, but I need a pro and a con for everything. Don't just sit there and say, these are the best 12 players, this is what we're going with. I need a genuinely thought-out process as to balance a little bit of, we need to go away and try and win. We also need to project for the future what it's going to look like. Then there's obvious injuries that come in with Beck Allen and those types of things that, you know, do obviously force change in that sort of space. So what was interesting, of the 8 women we had in there, and myself and you, Zoe, I think all 10 of us had different teams. Like, I don't think anyone doubled up. There was always someone that was a little bit different, which one goes to speak to the depth as to what we have to select from, but also just how different opinions matter. And one of the exercises we did with the women in that group is, okay, now go and pair up with someone and you have to come together and get a team out of this. So now you can't just like butt heads on this thing and say, no, I'm not shifting off this, I will pick this player. You've got to try and work it out and then amplify it by 2 more people coming in and then another 2 more people coming in and try and get to a solution at the end of it. Everyone's going to have a different opinion with this. So without sitting there and smacking everyone and saying, I can't believe they picked that player, like, what did you two think of team selection? I'll start with you, Zoe, because we were just talking about the Opals, but what did you think of team selection? Like, would you have gone about it differently? You don't have to name names or anything like that, but what did you think?
Yeah, well, if I was sitting in that chair with all of the information, I would have gone a different way. But I don't have all the information, so it's really hard for us to make that. Like, I don't know who's carrying things, who's not, who's available, who's not, you know, all that sort of stuff. I wasn't at camp to see who works well together and who doesn't, because sometimes, you know, you've got 10 players. Generally, your last two are the ones that you spend the most amount of time on. And sometimes the player that gets picked might not be the one that's the better player. They're just a better fit. So again, not being there, but yeah, if I was picking that team, then yeah, I would have gone a different way. I had a different group, but they're in the quarters, so you know, we're
easy after the fact, isn't it? Like, it's, oh, genius is the word. Because I was the same. I had a different team to what they selected, and mine was based purely on. For those of you that haven't spent much time around me in team selection, I'm always pick the younger. Like, I'm always about trying to blood new, younger players coming through. And I think we actually have a few coming through. So I went with a much younger group. I think it dragged our age or our aggregate age down from about 31 down to about 22. Like, I went super young.
I think
at
you
this
went
tournament.
A bit far.
I did probably go a little bit far. But I'm
someone's
okay with that
to.
Too. Yeah, got, you know, just trying to advocate for the youngers. Like, it's that sort of thing. So yeah. You do have to try and balance that out too. But obviously, we watch over the last couple of Opals games in particular, experience has been very valuable for them in that space as well. So it's not to say that I'm necessarily wrong, but I'm probably wrong. So it's that type of thing too, where after the fact, it's easy. Like, we can all sit there and say, oh, but if we had only just done this, but it doesn't work that way. Like, what about you, Coos? Like, you were kind of around, but you were very much heading World Cup mode at that stage as well when yeah. teams were getting picked.
Yeah, I think there's two really important caveats, which is one, we're in this wonderful place that we haven't really been in before, where the depth of talent, as you said, Rob, is the biggest it's ever been. Like, it doesn't fall off a cliff. It's not 10 or 12 clear-cut names, and then everyone else was just a squad member filler. Like,
yep. Remember 30 know. Years ago, we were all just praying that Luke Longley would play, and it's like, we're going to get our NBA guy. How good's this? We're going to be immediately good. And it's like, well, you know, now we're in a position where we're leaving out NBA guys.
That's right.
Like, it's crazy.
This is a great place, you know, for the Boomers and the Opals to be, and this is where we want it to be, and we want it to get harder and harder and deeper and deeper. So that's a really good one. And then the second part is both these teams, and again, you know, this is from the outside looking in, but both these teams seem to be in a really important transition phase right now. You know, there's a really strong core older group that's aging out and, you know, kind of starting to pass the torch, and the new crop is coming in. And so there's so many moving pieces to that. You know, who is the new leader? Who's the old leader? Who's ready to pass a baton? Who's ready to receive it? You know, again, the chemistry part that you both talked about, you know, who of the young guys can work together? Which of the young guys can work with the older guys? And so this is such a really niche time for both these teams, and to be going through that at the most important tournament that we can be at is pretty brutal, and I think we all need to have that little bit of perspective, that little bit of understanding that this is what's happening right now, and to see us still have some success, I think is awesome. Mm. I think it's really, really cool.
No, I couldn't agree with you more, and it is one of those difficult things. Like, put yourself in that position when you've had to pick a team in juniors, like. Put it in that sort of thing. You just get to pick the kids that are in front of you, and you don't have to think about anything else. Like, you're just looking for the 10 kids that will help you over the course of a season. These guys have to pick a team that will win in a tournament whilst keeping a lot of egos, personalities, roles happy within that, because there's some maintenance required for that, which we'll get into in a little bit as well. But then you have the brutality of the media and external opinions all having a voice as well. You have player agents that will obviously be advocating for their players in that sort of space. There are so many moving parts to this that it is not funny. It is, I cannot sit there and stress enough how hard it would have been to pick this. But as the coach, eventually you have to sleep at night, and you've got to make a decision that is, in your opinion, going to benefit you. And again, nobody's leaving out someone because, oh, yeah, I think they can win us a game, but I'm going to leave them out. Like, that doesn't happen. Like, people want to pick the people that are going to give them the best chance to succeed at that. And I don't think that's unreasonable either. So it is interesting as to how it all sort of played out. One of the, again, the few social media little grabs that I saw, I loved the Jack McVay, Will Magnay being told when they walk in the room. Like, Will Magnay, if he is now not my most favourite player in the world after his whole, did Jack hit him? Like, it was straight away, I'm excited, but now I want to know about my teammate that I obviously have a lot of care for. Phenomenal. Like, yeah. that clip in itself was worth its weight in gold. And even seeing Izzy Borlase on the women's side as well, yeah. being told, hey, you're making your first Olympics as a 19-year-old. Mm. Incredible. Like, money can't buy that type of reaction. So it is interesting with the team selection side of things as to what it looks like. I'll be honest, one of the people I had out of the Opals team has very much performed over the last couple of games. And I don't think it's fair to name names or anything like that, but I've got to sit there and repick my team after all this has happened, because I had them out and I had them with a limited role. And I think I was talking to someone during one of the games where it's like, geez, I'm not sure they really anticipated this would be their role for the tournament. Then all of a sudden came in, caught fire, and it's like, well, good job, Rob. There's a reason you're not picking these teams. Fantastic work there. But it's a really interesting one, because obviously you are dealing with unique styles, unique opinions that are all coming into that same sort of stratosphere as to what it looks like. With this type of a tournament, and I can talk to both of you because you've both taken teams away with 12 players in a 40-minute clock. How do you manage 12 players in 40 minutes, Coops? Like, what do you do in this space?
Very dependent on the scenario and the team. We obviously went away to Asia, you know, with our 16s group and played all 12. And I think, you know, the highest average was like 20 minutes, and we were able to do that. We're able to do that because we had a really talented group, we had a high character group, and the tournament wasn't particularly strong. So it was easy for us to do that, get up big and just rotate through bodies and so on. When you're talking about, you know, pro guys and girls, you know, at the Olympics, this is really, really hard to do. So, you know, establishing player roles is key. You know, really trying to get a good understanding through the group about what the expectation is for each person. Being able to have some transparency around utilizing strengths for opponents. And Rob, you brought it up off air. You know, if you watch the USA, they've basically been sitting one player out, you know, and rotating through. Like, I think Jason Tatum didn't play the first game, and then
yeah. Embiid missed one. And I've gone blank on who the third one was, but yeah.
And then I think I was watching the Puerto Rico game last night, and both those guys started. So, you know, obviously they've got their plan around that. But
what an awful outcome to have when you can just, you yeah. know, sit out an NBA champion and start them in one of your other games.
Yeah, yeah. The worst. But, you know, and then being able, okay, well, you know, you're a quick defensive guard. We're playing Puerto Rico, who's got a ton of quick guards. You know, this is going to be your game. But, you know, and then we're playing Serbia, big, strong, long, slower guards. Maybe that's not your game. So there's obviously a ton of strategies to put in place. But I think the more clear you are at the start, the more transparent you can be. And then also just, again, coming back to that selection piece, you know, of – like what Zoe said, that 11th and 12th, if you know you can't go that deep, do you really want to, you know, bring in a player that's going to expect to have big minutes, you know, on that roster position? And how are you going to handle that when they don't?
Yeah, well, you look at the USA, they left the roster spot open and Derek White was the late inclusion, who has been a breath of fresh air, in all honesty, because he just does his job. Yep. He doesn't care if he shoots it. He doesn't care if he plays minutes. He just turns up, defends, does what he does. And you look at it from a team selection perspective, it's kind of like your golf bag. Like, you know, you need a tool for all situations. Now, if I was playing golf, you'd need like 9 sandwiches. Like, but it is one of those things.
Did
where
you say sandwiches?
I know we're getting close to midday, but I promise you, I said sandwich. But it is one of those things. You need a tool for all situations, and that comes back to your team selection. Do you have something for every occasion? And you know, not every time do you have the opportunity to pick it that way. But it is one of those things where you do have to sort of forecast a little bit. It's like, geez, who are we going to run into? Like, if we run into Serbia, do we have enough bigs to throw at Jokic? Like, that is a genuine right. thought process that's probably going to have to go through your head in Boomer's team selection. Geez, we'd like to play small. Okay, if we go small and we run into one of those teams with a post, that might be game over before we've even started. So it's one of those things that you sort of take into consideration a bit. What about you, Zoe? Like, how do you go with it?
Coop's hit the nail on the head. Role clarity is really important. But I just want to specify, we're talking like Oz teams. We're not talking in the VJBL.
No.
Or be playing schools everyone. Yeah. or yeah. anything. You should be playing everybody.
Well said.
But this is like another level now. So, yeah, making sure they're aware. And it's also that they're aware and you have to be open too, that if you do, say, throw your 12th player on and they get the job done, just because you've said your role is this, of, you know, limited opportunity or whatever it might be, if they are good, play them. Like, it is one of those things. But then it's also, you've got to come back to that conversation of, hey, you know, we'll still see, but if it doesn't work, you know, there's a chance. Or, and understanding who you're coming up against is crucial. So especially in your pool games, you know, for the Boomers, like, you know, selecting, knowing you're coming up against Greece, selecting for, you know, how do we combat Giannis? Like, you know, we're going to have to trap the post, try and get him to catch it in the post so he's not coming downhill at us, and then try and trap that. So we need to be able to be in rotations. Do we have the guys to do that? But, you know, that sort of stuff is really, really important, which can then lead to some really good players missing out because they don't have the skill set you need. So, yeah, it's just making sure you're across all of that. And then once you've selected your group, and you can even test it in your camps as well of, you know, if you've got a green and gold game, for example, you know, sit a couple of players out and see how they handle it, you know, and if it's not handled overly well, that's probably a player that's not conducive to team harmony, because 12 players in 40 minutes is brutal.
Yep.
Like 48 minutes, I think it's definitely doable, but 40, you're rotating through so quickly that you just can't get a flow. Well, and
you look at how the USA have picked teams over the years too. Like, obviously that 92 Dream Team, just pick the best players and you'll be okay, because the rest of the world was so far behind where the US were at that point. And even
but even the 12th player was just Christian Leitner. Just pick the best college kid.
Yeah.
You know, like, that they knew that kid wasn't going to play.
Yeah.
Like, it was still like, let's not go 12.
Yep.
Yeah. We'll pick the 11.
Yeah.
You know.
True. That's a good point. And if you've ever seen that Dream Team documentary when they had that blue-white scrimmage in one of their camps and, like, Jordan and Magic are arguing over who has to take Leitner, it's like, oh, what a terrible outcome to have, you know, just the greatest college player at that current time. But you look at how the US picked their next few teams, they could just go with the best talent and look, at the end of the day, will be okay. Like, it'll be fine. Whereas you see now the rest of the world has caught up to the USA in a lot of ways, that they are coming with their own pros, NBA guys, EuroLeague guys, NBL guys that have had a lot of experience that can now walk into that and it's like, well, actually, we feel like we can match it with you. Now you can't just go and take your 12 players and tell them to figure it out. You've got to try and work out the chemistry and the harmony that's going on. Do you have the role player that is prepared to just move the ball? Like, if, you know, Steph Curry, obviously one of the greatest shooters we've ever seen. But are you just going to use him as a decoy? Like, probably not, but you can. But is he okay with that?
Yep.
Like, those types of conversations now start to be had amongst groups, and that's not easy to do.
Yeah, you can't have 12 ball-dominant players.
No.
Because there's not enough minutes and there's not enough basketball. So it's, it's really important that you get that balance, and you get that balance especially for something like a World Cup that covers different styles of play, because Europe – and even within Europe, but Europe's different to Africa, who's different to Asia, who's different to us. So, you know, you need to make sure you've got athletes that can cover all of those things. You know, it's when you play your more standard Asian teams, you know, you need speed. You can probably go smaller, but who's your big going to be if you're going to play small? Like, if you've got that versatile sort of four that
can stretch
and, yep, you know, all that sort of stuff, but can defend and stay in front of the ball. And then, yeah, you come up against your Europeans that are a little bit more bash and crash and, slower and a bit more execution. And then you come up against the Africans who physicality is just going to take over. Do you have the bodies? Do you have the strength? Do you have athletes that are going to just not crumble under that sort of pressure? So, yeah, it's – and then obviously the Americas that, you know, you get a bit of everything. Yep. But, yeah, it's – it's not as simple as come in and select the 12 highest scorers in their
position.
You know, position.
Yeah. No, without a doubt. And you touched on it earlier, tournament play is a different beast altogether. Like we've just ridden that roller coaster with the Opals in particular. They dropped that first game to Nigeria, had to beat the host nation in France in that last game to get over the line, and credit to them, they did when it mattered the most. But you look at, I think walking into that tournament, everyone would have sat there and said, okay, we'll beat Nigeria. Canada's going to be a toss of the coin, and you know, France, we, you know, again, we're probably unlikely to get, but that's where it'll sort of sit us. That should get us maybe second in the pool and life will be, you know, cruisy. You walk in game one, you lose to Nigeria, and it's like, oh, our tournament might be over after 40 minutes. Like, you never really know how that's going to look. And someone like that, that's the danger of what your draw can look like as well. Because I think for mine, I'd always want to play the best team in my pool first, because that's a bit of a free hit. You might get them before they've found their groove, before they've kind of worked their way into the tournament, those types of things. When you get the team that you feel like you should beat, that's almost fool's gold straight away, because they're coming in with that exact same mentality. It's a free hit for us. Like, we'll see how it goes. And you watched how Nigeria played the Opals in that first game. Great game plan. Like, for everything else, they did a great job of just working out, hey, here's who we are. Here's what we're going to do. Here's how we're going to play it. Like, I know I watched that game, obviously, with you, Zoe. Like, what were your sort of thoughts into that game and how that played coming out?
Well, I mean, like I mentioned before, they went to their strength, which was physicality. They monstered the ball and we turned it over a lot, and which again played into their – they were not so much an execution-based team. They still could execute in the half court, definitely not saying they can't, but we played into their hands by generating so many points off turnovers for them, which helped tick the scoreboard over and then – you know, got them into their run, but also tightened us up. So now all of a sudden, instead of just bringing the ball down the floor or advancing the ball through the pass, now all of a sudden there's that, I can't make that pass. I've got to, you know, dribble the dots off it, and, you know, which causes more problems and takes time off the clock and all that sort of stuff. So it was a real, it was very much contrasting styles of play. In the second half, the Opals did better. They seemed to adjust to it, and still more turnovers probably than what they would have liked, but there was a large adjustment to that, so that was good. But we've also got to, as a country, and I used to be like this, so certainly not going to say that I was an oracle that saw through this, but we've got to all accept now that the African teams can shoot. Like, it used to be a thing where you'd definitely go under the on-ball screen and you'd force them into that. That's not a game plan we can do anymore, because it's they're shooting the ball at good clips and at enough of a clip to either keep them in games or win them games. So yeah, there's and it makes it so much harder to guard, because the athletes that they bring are like nothing that we have. So it's adding to that, the basketball in Africa is coming, and we need to find a way to try and combat that. Starts with managing physicality and ball handling particularly, but also, you know, we might think we're open, you're not. Like, you've got to go and make that contact and create that space so you're holding them off, because if there's any type of gap or non-contact, they're shooting that gap and it's gone. So it's just that, again, like, it, when you play then more I don't mean to be offensive when I say this, but more traditional basketball countries, you probably are open. But, you know, against them, you're not. So you must make that contact. You must create that space. So then we're also taking the pressure off our guards, who are being absolutely monstered in the backcourt, both through pressure and length and athleticism, but also physicality. You saw there were times where I was like, oh, that's a foul. Like, but it's not called internationally, and we've got to get used to that.
I think with the African stuff too is not only is that nation really developing its basketball, but majority of those players don't live in Africa. You know, and you know this from the Mali team, the Guinea team we played against. I think one kid may have been actually from Guinea. I'd have to check that up. So, but majority of them were from the US. Majority of them are in France because the scouting down there, which ties into the development of that nation, is really good. They're going and getting kids out of there. They're putting them in European academies. They're putting them in American prep schools and developing the heck out of them. And then the kids want to go back and play for their country. And they're good. They're really, really good. And this is, they're not these teams kind of, you know, coming out of the woodwork. They're just not anymore. Like every team internationally, like you said, Rob, deserves to be where they are. They've come through. They play hard. And they're super talented. And it doesn't matter which country they're from. You know, and so I think we've got to get a better understanding of that, you know, when we're looking at results like that Nigerian game, like our Guinea game. And then just building on what Zoe said, like this has been such a fantastic tournament to watch from a defensive perspective.
Yeah, I loved it.
I mean, I don't think I've seen defense like this, you know, from a consistency standpoint throughout the tournament in how to be physical, how to use scheme, how to, you know, take teams out of what they're trying to do. Like, you know, if you're a budding coach, like if you really want to try and move through the pathway, you've got to sit down and really watch these games because they've just been outstanding. You know, you watch the way that Canada, on the men's side, the physicality and the switching to turn teams over and run has just been, you know, it's one of the reasons why they're doing so well.
Yeah, absolutely.
And why they're probably going to be in that gold medal game against the US. But, you know, that plays to their identity. It plays to the brand of FIBA physical basketball. And it plays to the refereeing. And we can't sit back here and look over there, oh, my God, it's so physical. Oh, that's a foul. It's like, well, it's not.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was one of the good things about CMC, I thought, where we worked with our refs here and we asked for any hands fouls you can call. But any body fouls, let it go. Like, because we want that physicality. And you saw the kids took a second to get used to it. But then by the end of day one, they'd figured it out. Like, and it started to become normal. So I think that was a really good test of that we can do this.
Well, and it's funny how often it happens. Like, we have the Saturday sessions, obviously, with the country girls that come in. And it's amazing. You've almost got to give them permission to go and climb into the ball. It's almost like, no, I've got to play 4 feet off this. It's like, no, you don't. Like, go and climb into it, be physical, be a pest, be annoying as you possibly can here, and just climb. Like, as a guard, I can only imagine, because I never played that position, but I would imagine after you've been scored on, getting the ball out of the net, turning around and seeing someone defending you 94 feet of the floor, it's got to be the worst feeling in the world. It's like, oh, good, this is going to be a lot of fun. Like, I'm going to be spent in 2 minutes here, and I'm going to have to check out. If you can apply that pressure up the floor, and you talk about Nigeria, they did. Canada, they did. They climbed right into our guards and just took time off the shot clock in particular. So now we're running late clock stuff all the time, or we're just chasing it back the other way as we're going to try and chase down layups.
You watch every team has had to have some sort of disruptive screen in the backcourt, some sort of punch or terror or smash, rub, whatever you want to call it. Like, they're really, the bigs are really active in knowing that there is pesky full court defense coming every game and they need to be prepared for it. And yeah, we're doing the same thing at Giddy Daniels Cup. You know, we're saying to the refs, like, hey, that you need to ref this like an international game. We want big time physicality. You know, if they take the shooting arm out, if they use two hands to steer the athlete somewhere, everything else, don't call it.
Let it go.
And, you know, I've started saying, like, I'm, you know, on this tour coming back from Istanbul about trying to get our athletes closer to an international brand of basketball, because I don't think I've done a good enough job of holding them to that level for long enough. So that's really what I'm bringing back for our development programs. And I'm saying to the athletes, foul. I'm like, we need to foul more. I'm like, in our program, we have to foul more. We can't let things like VJBL dictate what we're doing. We need to foul and push and hold and grab like they're doing it at the Olympics. And we need to do that in our environment to prepare for it. And then really it's on the athletes to make the adjustment on a Friday night until Friday night stuff catches up. But like I was in Ballarat a couple of weeks ago and I said to the athletes at the end of the session, I was like, what was the points of emphasis? What was the three things that I said throughout the session? They said ball pressure, international effort, and boxing out. Those are the only three things. And I said, oh, did I really coach you on the basketball? They're like, no. Nah. I said, because until we hit those three things to the level, we can't talk about the basketball anymore. Otherwise, we're just not preparing athletes well enough.
Well, and it's amazing how many times, too, when you look at that physicality, the guards had to give it up in the backcourt, throw it to the four or whoever it is to bring the ball down the floor. There are some nations that have gone and trapped that. It's like, well, that's the four that doesn't really want the ball in the backcourt. We'll go and get it. And there are others that are like, no, you carry it. We're fine.
Yeah, we'll
like,
deny the hell out of everything else.
It's not
else.
Coming back to the point guard. So you look at the schemes that have gone on, like the amount of scram switching we've seen over the course of this tournament has been out of control as well.
Just you know what we haven't seen much of?
Yeah, I know where you're going with this. For those out there.
Well, we haven't seen a lot of zone. I think I've maybe seen in the women's games I've watched, maybe three possessions of it, and it's not just the Opals games I've watched. So, you know, it's not played. It is played, but it's played as like a one-possession change-up or something like
been
that.
A bit of box and one I've seen from Spain. Like Spain's been used that a bit.
Scariola did, box and one but and 3-2.
Yep.
Yeah, but there's also been like we're going to show a zone and then on your ball reversal – now we're in matchup and, you know, all that. That's the fun stuff. That's how you use it. Like it's so it's really good to see. But, you know, then I'm hearing of games on Friday nights, under 16 VC, under 18 VC, boys and girls. You know, oh, how'd you go? Oh, we lost. Other team played a zone for 40 minutes. And look, yes, you've got to find a way to break it. Not denying that.
It's the usual retort that comes back is, well, it's your job as the coach to find a way to bust open this zone.
And you do.
Yep.
But for the love of God, like, we are watch those games. That's where we're trying to get our kids to. That's the pinnacle. That's what you should hang your hat on as a coach if one of your athletes happens to make it to that or a junior national team or even a state team and, you know, 16s nationals, there was far too much zone played. We've got to do something because if, it's going pear-shaped, zone is always our answer. Those kids are never going to figure out how to dig in and actually do what they need to do to be able to get games back at an international level.
And that physicality, that's just butchered completely. That physicality that you talk about there, Coops, go until the ref tells you you can't.
Yeah.
Like that's right. That's what we're at. Like as soon as the ref starts calling, like, no worries, adjust and figure it out from there. I would strongly suggest, having watched a lot of junior and international basketball over the last 2 months in particular, where it has been near on every weekend there has been something going on, nobody's punishing you from the foul line if you send them there anyway. Like it's my God, the free throw shooting has been disastrous. I was trying to look up the stats for the tournament that we've got going on at the moment and I can't quite see it. But my God, free throws will win and lose you games and save you heartache everywhere else. Just the inability to get there and make a foul shot when they need to make a foul shot has been astronomical.
Currently, I heard it this morning, currently, as of today, the Opals, I think, are last in the tournament and the Boomers are second last. And then if you look at the Crocs, we were second last in Asia and I think, again, second or third last at Worlds. And There's a lot of moving pieces. I just started listening to a podcast this morning on the way to work, which was some research done in penalty kicks. So it's on the Sports Psych show. I might give you the link, Rob, to put in the show notes. But it was interesting talking because obviously that's a dead ball type situation, a lot of mental aspects to it. So I think it's already quite an interesting listen. And I might have to get the book that's obviously associated with the episode. And then the other part too is, you know, you think about the makeup of the teams and it's our strongest kids and our strongest athletes that make these groups, which is great because that's what we want. But our strongest groups win so easily. Mm. And again, if you isolate our group and you look at in particular the 5 or five Vic Metro kids, I think we had. You know, they're not having close games on a Friday night because they're in their super teams. They're not having close games at a Nationals. And so when they get to the free throw line playing against, you know, Italy in the round of 16 and they have two crucial free throws, when was the last time they shot two crucial free throws? Like real meaningful free throws, you know, and it comes from, again, it's hard because we're so far away from everyone else, but trying to find those meaningful games and trying to replicate the highest pressure environments we can from a mental standpoint, I think is something that we really need to look at from a junior perspective. And I'm talking about us at state level, you know, not just nationally. And then when, you know, the kids are playing 1,000 games a week down here in Victoria, when are they supposed to practice free throws? You know what I mean? So at the end of the day, like, we can complain about us not being good free throw shooters, but when we don't give our athletes a chance to work on it, then we're not allowed to.
Yeah, and that's part of it, is we do need to replicate that environment at training sessions. So whether it be like a really high intensity drill or something like that, to have the kids puffing a fair bit and have to make free throws when tired, because that's really the key. The amount of free throws down the stretch that I've seen missed over the last couple of months has been catastrophic. It has cost multiple teams games, and that can break your tournament. Like, the amount of games that you see lose by single digits, but then you go back and look at the free throws and it's like, oh, we missed half of them. It's like, well, there's probably your game. And is it enough to maybe get you over the line? No, but it now makes an 8-point game, a 2-point game, other pressure and decisions come into it now. So the free throw shooting stuff, I've just done a terrible Google search and can't find what I'm after. So I'll move on from that point more than anything else. But it is interesting how often, like, what is supposed to be the easiest skill in the game, which is sticking a foul shot, you know, comes undone. And that's mental, because we've seen layups missed in the last couple of seconds of games as well that would have probably won games and those types of things. So it is incredible how often it happens. Transferring skill sets. So when we're looking at the Olympics as a whole and the skill sets that underpin that, what are the skills, in your opinion, that transfer the most from, say, a junior basketball into the Olympics? Is there anything that sort of sticks out to you, Zoe, that you sort of say, okay, that's one that I see appear here that will directly relate to there?
Shooting. Shooting and scoring and being able to score both sides of the body. I don't know what it's like on the boys' side at the moment, Coops, but on the girls' side, we have an epidemic of just completely avoiding the non-preferred hand. It's a problem. Because you can see the defense, as you guys mentioned before, the defense at the Olympics has been next level. So to ever bring the ball back towards the same side as the D it's not going to happen. It's, you know, so that sort of ability to be able to finish both sides of the body inside the paint and then obviously stick the open shot when it comes to you, and you just see, like, I think there was one of the games we were watching. I can't remember. I don't even know that it was Australia that was playing, but we were watching two teams play, and it might have been the Puerto Rico-Spain game.
Yep.
And Puerto Rico were working so hard to get scores. Like, it was, like, grinding almost. And then Spain are just, like, when they had their shot, just nailing it. Yeah. And, like, taking their opportunity and, you know, yeah, that sort of thing. And there was just such a difference in how – and Puerto Rico nearly won the game. And you just think, if they had the ability to just stick that heartbreaker, maybe it would have been a different story. But, you know, the ability to feet set, you know, locked target, stick at open shots is just – that's going to get you on planes. Like – and then obviously be able to defend, keep the ball in front, and play out of rotations. There's a lot of rotations in FIBA basketball because the athletes are bigger, stronger, faster, longer. So you are going to get beaten at some stage. Taking hits through the chest with chest blows and sending them to push points, but then knowing when enough's enough and going into rotations and playing out of that. They're probably the the two biggest, other than you know, handling the ball in the backcourt and being able to advance the ball. So it's a, we did a bit of work on it last night in Bendigo of, it's one thing to want to kick the ball ahead, but if you're not open, now the point guard has to dribble the dots off the ball and they get in trouble. So about how to get themselves open, so like bouncing off the corner and presenting, but it's not a straight line. It's into your D first and then create that space. So now it's an opportunity to actually be open. Taking that pressure off of that point guard, but they're the things. And I know I'm harping on it, but we will never get any of those things right while we sit in zones. None of them. We won't. We maybe learn how to shoot the three because that's kind of what you're given. But we won't learn how to finish on both sides of the basket because we can't get in there to do it. We won't learn how to rotate. We won't learn how to stay in front of the ball, and there's no ball pressure to be able to learn how to, one, do it, and two, be able to manage it. So please, please, like if we can just limit it. I'm not saying don't, but just limit it. It'll go so far into helping these athletes progress to the next level.
Yep. What about you, Coops?
So much transfer there from the women to the men. So yeah, like playing with contact, you know, or really embracing contact, you know, driving through a player, not around a player, coming to a 2 foot stop, you know, at the end of penetration. Ooh, like,
here we go, Coops.
You know, like really like shifting a defender to open up space, coming to 2 feet, and then, you know, having that ball security, that physical presence to be able to make that play, you know. So it's not even so much around, you know, kind of like taking a hit. It's more about initiating the contact to really control the environment. Like, you watch the best players at this tournament, they're controlling the environment. They look really comfortable with the ball in their hands. They look really comfortable dealing with physicality, initiating physicality, and that's why they're having success. So that's a big one. I think probably a step further with the shooting on the men's side is that ability to shoot the three off the bounce, especially against the drops.
Yep.
You know, you watch teams like that Puerto Rican team, you know, coming off, you know, seam ball screen, you know, Embiid's, you know, in that deep drop, one hard bounce, gather, you know, make that shot. That forces, you know, defenses to have to change coverages, and now you put yourself in the basketball game. So, you know, not only the ability to stick the open one, definitely on the men's side, if you can start adding that dribble before you're three, you're really going to put yourself in a good position to, you know, to wear international colours.
And even just the sidestep three. Like one where they're charging at you, that dribble to the side, that one to go. And
fake
the knowledge,
and skate.
Yeah, it really is. Yep. And that knowledge of where the sideline is in the corners.
Yeah.
But we've seen that turnover a lot again this tournament. And for the NBA guys, I get it. You know, smaller court, those types of things. It's hard to get a size 18 shoe in the corner without getting toes behind the three-point line. But it really is like that ability to hit it off the bounce and just a quick release. Like, I saw some stuff that Jack McVay was tweeting about how he needed to have a quicker release at this tournament because he's got to get rid of it. I probably suggest you don't go down the path of all the Jack McVay tweets at the moment, but there's been a couple in there that have been really valid with the whole, I can't tip the ball at this level because I just won't get my shot away. I've got to get it up quicker because that's the only window I have. And I think there's a lot to that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's such a great point. Like the speed of the athlete, the length of the athlete, you know, it just time. You just don't have time. It's the thing that goes the quickest, the higher you go. And so hearing Jack talk about that, and hopefully, you know, our athletes are listening to things and reading things like that and thinking about how that's going to transfer into their development plans. Probably the last one for me too is the screen setting and the screen use. And you watch.
I hope you're going with Sergio Lul here.
Well, it's just, you know, going back to the detail of, you know, like especially the screen setters, whether it's a ball screen or an away screen, you watch, you know, the teams like Serbia and Spain and so on. It's the screener goes to the man. Like, they go and initiate the contact. You see, Gobert is great at this. He uses his hands really cleverly to kind of come in, embrace the impact, you know, doesn't shove anybody to get the foul, but he gets as close to that defender as possible where he's initiating the contact to cause the reaction. And then obviously they're really smart in how they're separating out of that depending on the coverage. But taking the screen to the man and with our camp on the weekend, the amount of times we're working the punch screen on the three side, you know, in our motion, and the amount of times that players stop short. They would sprint and maybe a step above the elbow and just stop. And it's like, no, that can't do that. Like the screen's got to go to the contact. Yep. And then again, similar to what we're talking about with the physicality, but just that change of speed, that change of direction and using the screen. Like we're just not using screens as much as we used to. We used to talk about quite a lot when we were coming through. And I think that's probably, again, a bit of an indictment on us that we need to get back to some of those basics because, again, when you're talking about lack of time, lack of space, you know, a screen to create just that little bit of separation, whether it's like what you were talking about, Zoe, just to get open or to create a shot now becomes even more pivotal. You know, you can't just kind of run around and leave a guy a gap to get through. You know, I was watching a clip from our game again against Italy. You know, it was our very first play. We ran kind of a slice action into a stagger away. And we left such a gap in both those screening actions that they both got blown up really easily and forced us to have to create one-on-one off the bounce. And, you know, we needed to be better in that. And I think just for all our athletes, we got to get back to being better at that.
Well, just before you keep going, Zoe, it's funny how history kind of repeats itself. It's like, you know, flared jeans, they'll come back at some point. Like we've went away from on-ball screening for so long and just sort of said, hey, no, we're not doing this. It's stagnant offense. We want to get away from it. We've probably gone too far in that direction. And this is the self-correction that we need to go through, obviously, that we need to come back to some on-ball screening work and how to use them effectively to keep everything moving at the same time. Like that's a real big part, I think, of what we need to go through now. And like I know you go through it a fair bit, Zoe, with your girls as well, is like how to use an on-ball effectively. It is a two-person action, but it's actually a five-person action because you need to engage the tag defender. You need to get space on the other side of the floor so they can't help. All those types of things that start to impact on that as well.
Yeah, and it's tough because you are spot on, Coops. They are hesitant to make that contact. I even said it last night. I'm like, and there was there's a referee coach watching one of the domestic games, like in our stand. And I said, hey, go and make the contact. And if you push the referee to make the call, and if they call it, then we adjust. But let's push him as far as we can go. And he's like, head snapped around. And I was like, oh, I'm not talking to you. But I've noticed it in pretty much all of our leagues, to be honest, even national leagues. Anytime there is, particularly in the backcourt, but anytime there is severe contact, legal or not, it's called. So I can see why there's that hesitation. So we can sit there and blame the referees for that, or we can collectively continue to push that that's how we're going to set our screens to get that adjustment, because how do they learn how to make or not make that call if they're not seeing it regularly? You know, so I think we've got to, as coaches, once again, take a bit of a bullet and try and push that a little bit more, push that physicality. And so then it helps our referees learn in those instances whether it is or isn't. And mistakes will be made. But I don't think we shy away from it because of that.
I was actively telling athletes to foul and push at our camps on the weekend in the way that Nigeria got away with it, in the way that Spain got away with it, in the way that Canada is getting away with it. You know, push, shove, foul. We spoke about doing it in the spirit of the game. We're not trying to hurt anybody. Yeah. We're not trying to be silly with this thing. But we're trying to maximize the level of physicality allowed in our rules that we're seeing at the Olympics right now to be more impactful on the defensive end and help better prepare our offensive players to deal with it.
Yep. And it's really important, I think, on that on-ball screen play. One of the rules we've got in is if, as the screener, you're sprinting into your screen and you see a ball handler get antsy and go, you ghost out.
That's right.
Straight away.
Yep.
So we don't continue to run through our player. You ghost out. So then that's protecting, obviously, you and the safety of the defender.
Yep.
So, you know, because that's going to happen too. Like, we'd be stupid to think that every player holding onto the ball is going to be comfortable doing that while someone's climbing in while you're waiting for a screen to come. So, you know, there'll be times where they're forced into that. And there's, again, strategy in that as well. I've said any time I've had a scout be on this on-ball, particular on-ball, give them a baseline drive so that on-ball doesn't happen. Like, we're not in ice. Wherein I'm sending us into rotations because if we get the ball out of their hands, they're not as efficient. So they'll drive it, we'll be in rotations, the ball will come out, and that as soon as that happens, they're not as efficient anymore. So there's strategy with that as well that will sometimes send players to put the ball to the floor. And so having those little things in place of, okay, well, if you see him go, you ghost, and you're still separating, because what I've found on the girls' side in particular, they don't know what to do after the screen. So they set it and they kind of just stand there. Or they'll roll, but eventually. When that separation's just, again, you can see it at the Olympics, it's got to be lightning. If it's not, one can guard two, to really quote the great man next to me. And again, when we got through it a little bit last night in Bendigo and we started, you know, separating quickly, and all of a sudden, score, score, score. Now we've got to be better defensively, but you got to get good at something first so you can put pressure on, and that's how we should be attacking our sessions. So at the moment, the deficiency, let's say, is how to use the on-ball screen. So let's get good at that so we can then put pressure on the D of how to get better at that. And then the D gets so much better at that that now we've got to go to another level with the on-ball play and, you know, keep, you know, almost one-upping each other so you can make each other better in that skill set.
Yeah, I'm going to circle back to your two-foot finishing, Coops, because it is a bit of a pet peeve of mine at the moment. And I was very much in the early days when we started getting some access to Spanish basketball, we'd finish off one foot. I don't even care which foot. Like, just go one because it's quicker. Same hand, same foot. Cool with that. No worries at all. Inside hand, inside foot. Cool. If that's what you can get, that's what you can get. We've probably gone a little too far again in that direction where we do need to have our players starting to finish off 2 feet. Now, I'm okay with whichever hand, whichever foot, when you're out on the break and there's nobody else in front of you. But when you're coming at defenders that are not stationary, but are already established in their defensive positions, the need to finish off two, because you are going to get some physicality from them from different directions. Like, it is 360-degree contact. It's coming from everywhere. But also your ability to move them with a little bump. Like, it is, generally speaking, lowest person wins and person to initiate contact first wins. They are the two things I do see a lot. So I think if we're going to go down this path of, you know, our finishing needs to be better, we need to look at the footwork first, because I think the footwork playing off a 2 foot stop will allow you to make a better decision. You won't get hit when you're coming off 1 foot in the air and just be a quivering mess falling out of court. You're used to that contact, you're balanced for that contact, but now you can start to see shooters a little better as well. It's the implications down the line. I mean, if you're going to go, everything has to be a 1 foot finish, it's a really naive way to go, and I would strongly suggest you don't go down that path.
Yeah, you're just setting up your athletes to fail. You know, like, you just can't do that.
Yep.
You know, firstly, you've got to talk about the scanning, because as you just said, Rob, there is no defensive 3 seconds in FIBA basketball. 9 times out of 10, you're going to get met at the rim by some sort of defensive pressure. And playing off 2 feet allows for ball security, allows for time, allows you to pick a pivot foot, all those sorts of things that we value. It has to be taught first. The 1 foot stuff can come later.
Yep. I agree with that. I'm not saying don't do it. Yeah. I'm just saying afterwards.
That's right.
I think the 2 foot stuff, you've nailed that, because 2 foot first, and then you can get into the other creativity part.
100%. Like, we've got, on the boys' side, we've got our SDP top 30 camp coming up. So we're rewarding what we think are the top 30 athletes in terms of dedication to the program and potential for the next level. The first session on day one is 2 hours, and it's been themed international toughness. And for 2 hours, we are working on 1v1 full court defense, boxing out, playing off 2 feet, screen setting, and relocating after the cut.
Like, listening to that, I wouldn't mind being the 31st player and not having to go through that for the first 2 hours. But there's a lot of value in that. I'm good with that.
Yeah, I'm, maybe I'm going to get a lot of RSVPs declining.
I'm sick.
I want the one where it's just, can I just come in and get shots up? Yeah. Like, that'd be great. But that's what it is. Mm. Like, and it obviously is. We've spoken a lot about the physicality during this podcast. And honestly, I don't think anyone can watch the Olympics and sit there and say, what we have here in Victoria looks like the international game. It's just different. And very, very obvious reasons. Like, we don't need to go into the depths of that. But we also have to be okay with occasionally not calling a foul at practice, with occasionally initiate a little bit more contact. When was the last time you saw a bump bag at a practice? Like, they've almost disappeared over the last couple of years. I know Saturday, Zoe, like, I was the one on the bag. And Dustin Van Eyck, who copped one from one of the...
He did. Oh, man. He had the guards. I thought it was going to be, oh, you know, give the big guy the bigs and the smaller guy the guards. And she went in with a ball of steam and got him. Yep. So it was
Zoe,
good.
Then Zoe forgot how long it was going for and just heard this, like, heavy breathing behind her. She's like, oh, I didn't bring the
dogs
today.
Who's having an asthma attack?
Oh, no, it's Rob, who's just been smashed by the bigs for the last 25 minutes as they just literally run at him, deer in the headlights with a bump bag. But those types of things I think are great ways to do it. Now, obviously, do it in a safe way. Like, don't start loading up with, like, pool noodles and just swinging for the fences like your Babe Ruth. That doesn't work. Contact the right way. And there's ways to go about that. I think there's a happy medium that we can find. So do it in a safe manner and you'll be okay in that world. But toughness is a skill, and without going down, because we might actually do that in a couple of weeks' time, is talk about that Jay Billis article on toughness. Like, that's, I haven't revisited that thing for over 10 years now, just to see if it's still valid, and go from that point. But toughness is a skill, and one of my favourites, Deli checks in against Greece, and I am certain he turned that game by himself by just doing the tough stuff, and that is the box out, the kick ahead pass, the defend,
diving,
the
on
deflect, the stuff that you would sit there and say, that's why you got picked. That, for mine, is a great selection. And I know it was heavily criticised by a lot of people. I would still take Deli. I would.
Oh, for mine, his pick was justified in game one.
Yep.
When, who do we play? Spain. I can't remember. Spain, yeah. Yep. And it looked like it was going to kick off. Yep. Like, it looked like there was going to be, I think it was Josh Green and another player were looking like they were... And
Garuba.
So then other players started to come, and Deli just grabbed them all.
Yeah, and just four players backwards.
Walked them all backwards.
He caught one in the back too, from memory. Yeah.
And turned them away.
Yep.
And then got them back on track. Mm. For mine, that pick was justified in that moment.
Yeah, no, he's an absolute belter. Like, if we could have 10 Delis, I feel like we'd be tracking along. Okay, maybe not 12 because we'd struggle to get them in a 40-minute game. But 10 would be fantastic. But that does wrap us up. Obviously, take all of this with a grain of salt. This is our view from the couch with the chips on our stomach as we're watching through this sort of stuff. Heard a great podcast the other day I was listening to. One of the questions was, what individual sports do you think you could beat Simone Biles at? And cricket. Like, they had nothing for it. And it's like, I don't think we could beat her at anything. Like, long jump, high jump, she'd still have us in that. They're like, maybe she's not great off the tee on the driver. Like, maybe golf. Like, but that'd be about it. This is the privilege we have of being able to watch literally world-class athletes go about their business on the day-to-day. So it is phenomenal to be able to have a watch in that. The Stan subscription has paid for itself, honestly. This past month has been brilliant to be able to just go back and have a look at all the games. So hopefully, by the time we come back to you, we've jagged two wins against Serbia and we're charging on towards medals and we're not going through customs at Melbourne Airport on the way back. So, fingers crossed for that. We'll see how we go. Thank you both for jumping in. Appreciate your time as well. Coaches, thank you very much for listening and we'll catch everyone next week.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Talking Split Podcast. Make sure you like and comment on your favorite podcast platform. And don't forget to share and subscribe so that you never miss an episode.